Type in the name. We always say fiction / non / fiction podcasts because you got to put the slashes in. And we that was a thing that we did that looked cool at the beginning. And now we're like, God, that was maybe not a smart idea.
In a way we go. It's CNF, the creative nonfiction podcast. Show where I speak to badass writers, podcasters, as the case may be, and whoever the hell else about the art and craft of telling true stories. I'm Brendan O'Meara. Hey, welcome, CNFers. Today I'm highlighting, showcasing, headlining Vivi Ganeshanathan, better known as Sugi, and Whitney Terrell, the co-host of the Fiction Nonfiction podcast. They throw a lasso around the two and genres and corral them for one toe tap and good listen. Their thing is that all the things you see in your Twitter feed have likely been covered in some way in literature. It's part of the Lit Hub radio network. Go check it out. If you already haven't, I bet you have. Look them up on Twitter and Instagram. Sugi is the author of the novel Love Marriage. She's an essayist and journalist and instructor at the MFA program at the University of Minnesota. Whitney Terrell has spent tours in Iraq as a reporter, and he wrote the novel The Good Lieutenant. His work has appeared in the Washington Post magazine, The New Republic, and a billion other places. He teaches creative writing for the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I was punching way up in weight class in this podcast, as you will soon notice. You hear what I mean. Plus, if you've seen that episode of Seinfeld where Jerry shaves his chest hair, so that kind of happened here. Oh, you'll see. Do you want to hear any housekeeping or do you want me to just get on with it? Stay tuned for my parting shot. For what it's worth, it's not a whole lot this week. Call for submissions for the audio magazine, some Patreon riffing. I want to give a shout out to Brett Smith, Isidra Menkos, and Suzanne Biro for jumping on the CNF and bandwagon at the Patreon membership page. So big ups, big thanks, and big ass shout out because you deserve it. And that's it for now. So here is the brilliant duo behind the Fiction Nonfiction podcast, Sugi and Whitney. Oh yeah.
Lunch that we had.
I think it was at AWP in the spring of 2017. We had met in the fall of 2016. I was visiting faculty at the Iowa Writers Workshop, and Whitney came back for a memorial service for James Allen McPherson. And so we met there, and then we were both going to AWP, and he said, "Do you want to grab lunch at AWP?" And I was like, "Sure, sounds great." And I was like, "Oh, we're going to have a fun drink. That sounds fun." And then he was like, "I have an idea."
We got drunk in Iowa though, up there at what was that club?
I don't remember what it was called, but it's there? Yes, it's true. There were a number of
Right near campus.
Yeah, and we were with some of Jim's other former students. But yeah, I don't remember what that because that club hadn't been there when I was a student, and it was sort of a place with artisanal cocktails. And
it was fancier than anything I remember hanging out at.
Yeah, as a graduate student, I would not have come here.
But so we met and talked about writing, and I really liked what you had to say, and I was really interested in your, background as a journalist and everything. I thought we got along well, and you were fun to talk to. And then I had been thinking about this idea of doing a podcast that was said, all the news that's in your Twitter feed or on the evening news, as we say, every podcast, has already been written about in literature. And I've been looking for someone to do that with, cause I didn't want to do it by myself. And then after meeting Sugi, I thought, okay, this is the person. And then we had that lunch at AWP.
Yeah, it was really fun. And it was really funny because I remember when the podcast started, people were like, "How many times have you met Whitney in person?" And I was like, "I think it's been twice, maybe three times." And people were like, "You're doing a podcast. Do you know how much work a podcast is? You're doing a podcast with someone you've met three times." And I was like, "It's going to be fine." You meet Whitney three times and you would know that it would be fine. And yeah, it was just funny because like a lot of people sort of spoke to me like, oh, you're taking this enormous risk. And I was like, no, I don't think so. And yeah, I mean, I just have to give Wood a lot of credit for, I mean, it was his idea. It's a great idea. And I think he sort of really had the chops to make it so that we actually did it, which is like a combination of force of personality and like know-how and then ability to acquire know-how that he didn't already have. And to encourage me to do the same. And so, I don't know, like now I own a Yeti microphone and I'm speaking into it, which is an exciting development in my life. And I've also, I think, you know, it's been great for me as a teacher and as a writer to sort of like think about, right, it's essentially like having, like I have a coworker who's not in my department. Like that's a great treat. And so there's like also, again, like that freshness of perspective. I feel like Whitney has doubled my mental Rolodex as a teacher. So now they're sort of just, you know, I don't know, I'm teaching a class. I'm like, huh, I could assign this thing or I could assign this thing that we talked about on the work on the podcast. And I know less about it, but I've had more interesting thoughts and like more recently in conversation with Whitney than I would have had by myself. And sort of, I think even that structure of doing things with another person, like I was teaching that humor class this term and I was like, oh, being in dialogue with Whitney was a great way to do this. And if I'm teaching this comedy class, there's someone in another department teaching a comedy class. Like if we do comedy lectures together, like each class will have that benefit of like a little sneak preview into the other. And that worked. And I think it was much more interesting for our students to see a conversation and student teachers asking each other questions. And so I think like, I don't know, I find that the structure of the podcast to be really fun. And I think it's in part because we have like some of the same vocabulary from having had common experiences as students. And with, you know, we have a lot of the same friends, but we know them in totally different ways.
Well, I would add that, I mean, the thing that I we don't have the same friends. Like you have brought a lot of guests to the podcast, like know a lot of people. You're very affiliated. You have a lot of friends. I have a lot of friends, but they're not exactly the same friends. And we're, you know, so the people that you have brought on as guests, you know, were people that I would never have asked. I mean, you know, Britt Bennett was a suggestion that you made and Kiki Petrosino and Danielle Evans. I mean, you've suggested some of our great, you know, some of the great guests from some of our best episodes, you know, so that to me, that has been the way that we've been able to work together to find good guests for the show. And it has way opened up my, like, it's opened up the world of writing in America to me in interesting ways. And I've met people that I wanted to meet, but didn't know that I wanted to meet necessarily. So that's been great for me.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've had the great good fortune to have wonderful emerging artists and also really established people on our show. And sometimes one is leading to the other. Like, so for example, we had the novelist Maurice Ruffin, who's from New Orleans, on the show. And then we wanted to do the next episode at the student's suggestion on the anniversary of Katrina. And we said, Maurice, you know, who can you suggest to us? And he mentioned Christina K. Robinson, who I hadn't heard about before that. And she's a visual artist and writer and just sort of thinks about visual language in this stunning way. I mean, she's brilliant and he's brilliant. And I mean, I just have been following all of the stuff that she's done since. And it's a treat to kind of watch these conversations lead from one to another in these ways that, I don't know, like expand the way that we get to think about things. So it's been a lot of fun to juxtapose things that you wouldn't necessarily, I mean, as Whitney was saying, like, I mean, just to put together someone Whitney knows with someone I know and then watch them have a conversation that neither one of us would have imagined in the first place on our own is very cool.
Well, the interesting thing was that I was not listening to a lot of literary podcasts. I was listening to political podcasts. So I was listening to, I think originally, you know, like, Slate's Political Gab Fest is probably one of the oldest political podcasts. They just celebrated their 15th anniversary. They were one of the very first, you know, big podcasts. But I listened to that show. So, I mean, we're in our fourth season, so 4 years ago. I mean, I was still, I listened to 538's podcast. But I was listening to news podcasts, and I was constantly thinking, like, God, if they could also talk about this Borges story, was really relates to this, you know, and that would never come up. And so I just kept having ideas that I was writing in my notebook about like the way the news seemed to be imitating or refracting through books that I had read, but they were books that were 100 years old or 10 years old or whatever. And that the political people weren't aware of them. And the political Gab Fest would have a little thing at the end, which they would call cocktail chatter, where they would maybe plug a book or so or something like that, but they would never relate that book back to what they had just been discussing in the political section of the show. And I just felt like many writers that I knew were incredibly good at talking about politics and were passionate about politics. And I was also seeing writers write about politics on social media, but not get a chance to talk about it in a podcast form. And I just thought, you know, that I knew we would have no problem finding guests. I knew that writers would want to do it. I knew that there would, you know, so that was how, that was what I was listening to. I don't know what's, Sugi, I'll be interested to know what your schedule is, but I mean, I end up having to work on the podcast at night. And I just, I do the podcast, I mean, when it comes to editing or writing scripts or whatever, and then I try to write in the morning from like 9 to 1. And, or if it's, you know, 3 hours is fine. So I just try to protect a morning area, and then the rest of it is free game. So either grading or working on the podcast is anything outside of that 3 hour writing space.
Yeah, I think well, in the pandemic time, it's been really weird. And actually, next term I'm not teaching, so my schedule, I'm sure, will dramatically change. Yes, it's delightful.
God damn it! That's not fair.
I think, you know, it's one of those leaves you apply for before the pandemic, and then the pandemic happened, and you still have the leave.
So jealous. I can't even talk to you.
That's it, everyone. The podcast has ended unceremoniously in this moment. But yeah, I mean, as someone who teaches, you know, I think my best times creatively are often at night or in the afternoon. So I think I sometimes am working the opposite way that Whitney works. And I think I also probably have slightly more irregularity for just a variety of personal reasons. So I have had to work ad hoc around those. And I think, you know, the things that I try to hit every day are to write and to read something that is like for fun, even if it's like a paragraph that is not for class or not prep for something. And that is a nice touchstone. And then also, I definitely do better when I exercise. So just anything, any day. And so I also, Whitney and I both got pandemic puppies. Yeah, I'm looking forward to our shameless advertising campaign for our podcast featuring the dogs. But the dog is definitely like really improved quality of life in that she's like, would you like to go outside? And I'm like, I wouldn't. It's really cold. We live in Minnesota. And she's like, no, let's go anyway. And no matter how cold it is, that's always, you know, the link between walking and writing has been well documented by so many people. And I think it's also true for me. So like those walks have been really helpful to kind of clear my head and think about in a big picture way. I'm like, oh, I'm going to go back to my desk in half an hour. What is it that I want to get done? Or what did I just do? And how can I like process it? And the podcast, I mean, also like just provides a kind of like every 2 weeks, this thing is going to happen.
I am super more organized because of it. Like I cannot fuck around anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, like there is no time for that, you know? So it's like, you know, if I'm going to write a script for this thing, I'm just going to do it. I don't get to have the, like, I need to think about this for, you know, like it's happening. And sometimes we have to crash these scripts. I mean, we do have to write them. I don't know, Brennan, what you do because you're doing a single voice, because both of us are talking for it to work. We have to sort of write out what we're going to say. And right. Sugi and I will be up the night before a show, both in a Google Doc. We've co-written scripts really fast, you know, and it's the first time I've ever really written with someone like that, but we're both in there, you know, just like talking on the phone and writing the script in a Google Doc at the same time. Like, we got to do this in an hour. Here we go. You know, and that's an interesting sort of new way of writing for me, really. I also really hate that feeling when I'm listening to the final, I mean, like we get the last draft of the final audio back from the producer, and I'm listening, and I listen to it while I'm jogging, usually on a Wednesday, and the thing comes out on Thursday, and I think, oh my God, I should have asked this, you know, like that doesn't happen very often, but when it does, it's a bummer. And you know, the script is the thing that I think that helps you not feel that way.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say that it sort of is, I mean, along the lines of what Whit said before about outlines. I mean, it's great to have the outline, and then so much also, you know, we improvise and diverge from the scripts also all the time. And that often, like sort of the surprise of the moment when one of us kind of decides to do that or ask a question that is in the script is also, I mean, it's the fact that we have the freedom to do that. Like, I think the script provides a certain sort of security, but yeah, I think like it's funny, like the facsimile of like kind of a freewheeling.
If you're boring banter. That day, you have the script.
Yes.
You
know? Exactly. And I remember sort of like realizing, I was like, oh my God, we're going to script the banter. I was like, the banter is scripted. Like, we're not, like, all of the banter that I've ever seen was probably like, so much of it must have been scripted. You know, and I think of kind of, I used to assign in that comedy class, like His Girl Friday, the kind of, you know, she walks in the newsroom and she's sort of like, blah, 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 blah. And she's got this like very fast paced, witty thing. And of course, you'd like to think it's off the cuff. But in fact, she wrote it in a Google document the night before, thinking very carefully right. about it.
Sometimes we would have the interns get to write scripts as part of being an intern, and they'll write in parentheses banter here. And we're like, no, that's not, that's not how this works.
Some of them have written great banter for us. It's really funny. Like what they essentially are like, I remember having an intern be like, so I'm writing in Whitney's voice. And I was like, yes. And they were like, well, what sort of jokes would Whitney make? And I was like, you tell me.
Bad ones. I mean, one of the interesting things about podcasting is that there's no gatekeepers, which is a positive thing because voices get on the air that aren't like our podcast allows writers to do things that they don't otherwise get to do. You know, NPR doesn't call up Claire Massoud, who's going to be on our next episode and ask her to talk about politics all the time. Right. But she's a fantastic novelist and would be interested in talk about that kind of stuff. Right. So the fact that we don't have to ask someone permission to do that and we can just get on the air and do it. And we have the support of LitHub, which really helps, you know, is a good thing. But it also means conversely that, you know, people can go on and be bad and nobody's going to tell them that they're not. You know, I mean, their listenership, I think, will eventually tell them. But yeah, I mean, I think it allows people to imagine that they can do something that they're maybe not putting in the effort to do well.
Well, I think, as you know, we mentioned the scripts already. Whitney had written scripts, I think, before doing the show, and I really hadn't. I remember an early piece of feedback. He was editing the audio when the show started, and he was like, have you considered finishing your sentences? I was like, wait, how often do I not finish my sentences? And he was like, I don't know, like one out of every four. And I was like, oh God, that's horrible. I'm sorry. He was like, just make my life easier and finish your sentences. Don't just trail off. And so sort of paying attention to my own verbal habits and then listening to the audio and being like, oh, I said like a lot. And I mean, some of it is I'm going to sound like who I sound like. That's okay. But being conscious of those habits has been helpful. And you know, I remember early on in those scripts, I would sometimes write questions and the questions would have multiple questions at the end of them. And that's maybe fine in a written interview, but in an audio interview, you can only ask one question and then generally the person will start answering because they're listening to you. So that was another habit that I got rid of. And then I think also having a little patience for someone developing a thought. But I think, you know, we also... we'll often we're generally giving our guests a heads up about what we're going to talk to them about. So we're trying also to not necessarily like we're not trying to put it's not a gotcha podcast. We're not putting people on the spot. So trying to ask them questions that will give them an opportunity to talk about things they're excited about.
Yeah, I would say the thing that the podcast has done for me is made me feel much more connected to the world. I mean, when I'm working, I'm you know, coming toward the end of a novel that I've been working on now for like 4 years. And usually during that period, I feel very isolated and like outside of the literary community and not really participating and I'm not publishing heavily. And this way I'm like talking to writers that I know sometimes that are friends, but others that I don't know. And I have a daily, you know, a bi-weekly product that I'm putting out there. It's like publishing regularly. And so I feel much more engaged. And for that, it's like super useful. It helps my writing. It helps my thinking. It helps me think about how, you know, it also sort of takes away that pressure of being out of the marketplace for a long period of time during which you're working on a novel. So I like it for that. I think when we're dealing with subjects that when there's a crossover between subjects that I'm writing about or that I'm passionately interested in about, and then we get to talk about them on the podcast. So I think things that we have talked about, some of our best episodes have been about race and identity and writing across different identities and thinking about that as a practice, which is something that I do in my fiction. But I want to talk to writers from different identities than mine about that issue. That is very exciting to me. We did a couple of back-to-back podcast episodes on whiteness with Timothy Yu and Jess Rao that I thought were really good. When we're dealing with issues like that, I find that to be really helpful.
Yeah, I think my favorite episodes are the ones where either I get to talk about ideas I've been thinking about for a long time, but with people who view the topic in a totally different way or just in a, from a different angle. And then also just things that make me think about aspects of craft and how they connect to politics. So, I mean, I still all the time think about, like, we did an episode on trans writers and we had T. Fleischman on, and T. said, talked about how people think of, like, the word trans woman as a metaphor for a woman.
Yeah, I remember
and
that.
I just was like blown away. I just think about that sentence all the time. And just like, how are all of these, I mean, things about language, what are all of the things that are parts of our fingerprints? And we're just taking them for granted. We're just have inhaled these assumptions. And how can I like pull them out of myself and like take a look at them and then decide if I want to use them or not? Because I thought that was so accurate. Like, I'd heard people do that, but I hadn't heard anyone articulate it in that way. And so, I mean, that's an example. Or, yeah, I mean, we did episodes on race and publishing and with Donielle Clayton and Aisha Pandey. And, you know, we also did two episodes on mass incarceration and to talk to people who had written about, you know, the experience of being incarcerated in America, which is a common experience in certain, like, right, a terrifyingly common experience and especially among, like, Black populations, like Native populations, Latinx populations, right? Like there are communities where that's a disproportionately high number of people being incarcerated or having encounters with the police. And to sort of talk about what kind of language do we use for that was really helpful to me as some of these events and things were unfolding around us.
And I think there's a sense of involvement there because that's an issue that I had heard a lot about, read a lot about, but hadn't written about and had done nothing about, right? You know, and at least if you're going to get some really terrific writers on who can talk about this and express their, you know, their expertise on that subject and get their words out to more people, at least you feel like something, you know, you're doing something other than just feeling about it, you know?
I think in recent years, I've been much more interested in writing fiction, but every once in a while, I think especially when I see the mainstream press cover something in a way that I think is not great, then I sometimes feel an urge. But I haven't really, I don't know, had the bandwidth to do much other than fiction writing in recent years. And I do miss it. I think my idea of the fantasy place to write a novel would be in the middle of a newsroom. Like if someone would just give me a cubicle and plant me in the middle of the newsroom and let me write my novel surrounded by all of that news chatter, I would be delighted.
Do newsrooms even exist anymore, Sugi? I don't know. I mean, I remember newsrooms from when I was at the Kansas City Star, but I don't think you could find them anymore.
Well, I think in pandemic era, right, there was just that story about the Hartford Courant in the oldest newspaper in the United States that is in the city where I was born. And they've given up their office. Like they're still going to publish, but I was like kind of horrified at the idea that their newsroom. Yeah. I mean, plenty of newsrooms
are
gone.
The newsroom that I used to work in at the Star is condos now.
Oh God. Yeah. I think sometimes the thing I miss more than journalism or as much as journalism are just journalists. And of course there's overlap between fiction and nonfiction writers as our show addresses. But I find that often people who are in the business of reporting the news, their brains just seem to work at a different speed than other folks. And it's just, they're a joy to be around. And yeah. Since they're often not in academia in paths that necessarily cross those of fiction writers, that is a thing that I miss.
Well, I was just going to say, going back to your original question, when you were talking about like, well, I start writing fiction and I just think, well, I'll just make this nonfiction because I can find a real person. For me, it works exactly the opposite. I've always, even when I was reporting as an intern reporter at the Kansas City Star, thought, boy, I could turn that into a short story. You know, so I've always sort of explicitly used nonfiction as a way to find information to write fiction about. I mean, it was most explicit when I wrote my last novel, The Good Lieutenant, which I went to Iraq twice as a reporter, but I knew I was going to write a novel. But the only way that I could get into Iraq and find out enough about the place to write a novel was to write nonfiction starting with that. So my approach has been kind of the opposite. I don't feel like there's a difference between, you know, I mean, between creative nonfiction and fiction. The idea that one would be loftier than the other is sort of, I mean, that was what people thought in the 60s maybe, but I, you know, my, one of my professors in college was John McPhee, and he would get really pissed if anybody ever said anything like that, because it sort of was his life project to prove that there was every bit amount of creativity and interest and talent and skill in writing creative nonfiction as writing fiction.
Yeah. I mean, I think I would agree with that. I've been running a creative nonfiction graduate workshop this semester. It's been my first time doing that in a while. And the stuff that we're reading, the stuff that we discuss, it's just as creative, if just in a different way than running the fiction workshop. And it was nice for me to return to that actually after a little bit of time away. And McPhee is a great example of someone who, I mean, my God, what a beautiful writer. So kind of acquainting, I feel like there is sort of like an old school, there was, I think, an old school snobbery of poetry and fiction sort of in relation to creative nonfiction, right? And I don't know, in terms of formal training or what have you, like maybe it's the latecomer to the scene, but I don't really see that. I mean, you can find great old school essays. You know, it's not a new form. And then you can also find these like really fascinating works that sort of travel the line in between, like fake memoir or I don't know, like non-fiction purporting to be nonfiction or the other way around. And I mean, there were periods of time when people cared so much less about the differences between genres. And I think I'm thinking of, and there might have been an essay about this on LitHub, but of course, when the pandemic started, I was thinking about like Journey of a Plague Year, which I studied in journalism school, and it's a novel. And it's a like recounting of a plague. And it's sort of masterful in its, the way that it kind of renders like, wait, how do we convey that we think something is real? Like actually in fiction and nonfiction, the tools are often really the same.
Well, I mean, Sugi and I are both trying to finish novels right now. And at this stage, I think where we've read, I looked at hers and she hasn't looked at mine yet. And, but you know, that period where you're trying to get over the hump and get a novel done is, I, at least for me, one of the most vulnerable periods, because you've already put in a lot of time and you're like, but what if this isn't the thing that I thought that it was? And I have that experience with every single novel that I've written, and I find that difficult. That's I think where I feel the most vulnerable. Like, why didn't I figure out how to do this sooner? Why am I 4 years into this and I'm not done yet? What is wrong with me? Why didn't I should have written this in 6 months. Joyce Carol Oates would be done by now, you know? And so then, you know, that's for me, that's the hardest period.
That's interesting. Cause I think it's, I mean, maybe it's like the interregnum, right? Like the period of time between when the president is elected and when they take office, it's like, oh, I finished a first draft and someday this book will come out. But what will that period after the inauguration be like? I'm not really sure. And I think, I don't know, there's a sort of like strange period of like private limbo and uncertainty and speculation that, yeah, I mean, that's for sure part of the uncertainty and insecurity. I do think that, I mean, I've never written, I mean, I don't think I've ever written anything, an essay, a piece of journalism, a short story, a book that did not turn out to be something different than I thought it was. So I think if I think of that as like more of a, like a reassurance, like this will be guaranteed to be weirder in some way than I had originally planned or conceived. Like I will never get it to actually line up, but maybe that will produce something more interesting. I guess, I don't know. It's like a world of uncertainty. And because the uncertainty is rooted in yourself and not in others, like you can't even necessarily like, I mean, it's not always, I think there are plenty of scenarios where one's urge with an insecurity is to kind of put the blame in other quarters. And I think here, like so much of it just has to do with oneself. So that's always fun.
I don't get a lot of feedback these days because, you know, it's in a weird way, you're more isolated as you get an agent and have an editor, you know? So the most feedback I get is generally from my agent, who is an excellent reader. And mostly it's like, you're doing a terrible job. I know when I give it to him, like he is like the princess in the pea, right? So if there's even a minor problem, he's going to wake up bruised and like, oh my God, we can't use this bed. This bed's a disaster, you know? And so, but that's what I want. I want like the hardest read possible. And I've learned, they used to get super nervous about that. But now I realize, okay, all right. I can listen through what he's saying to what the real problems are and sort of think, okay, I do need to change this and I do need to change this. And so if it's direct, I'd much rather have it be direct than nice, but indirect.
Yeah. And I think that like that sort of feedback, sometimes I'm just looking for a sense of how someone feels. Like I have what a friend I went to grad school with who is a poet. And so we were never in class together. And she's like a wild and good reader, but I mean, her feedback is sometimes like she'll get to page 11 and she'll be like, this feels incorrect. I'm like, do you have any more specifics? And she's like, no. And I'm like, but she's always right. And so figuring out that she was always right was really helpful for me. So sometimes, I mean, I think also there are people who are great at articulating their feedback, but I think also learning how to value the feedback of people who are trained in different ways. Like another really good reader for me is my college roommate, who's a lawyer, who she has an uncanny memory. I mean, she remembers things I said when I was 19 that I don't recall. And she'll both psychologize what I've written and be like, oh, this part is about like this preoccupation that you have with this thing. And I'm like, oh God, like, please don't tell me that. I don't actually want to know. But then that sort of feedback is also hugely useful for revision, her level of precision and the minutia, and also just the like her sense of history with me is really informative. And then I also get a lot of reads from people who I write mostly about Sri Lanka. So sometimes I talk to people who work on Sri Lanka and other fields. Specifically, there are a couple of anthropologists who I will often ask to read my work, and they can provide me with a sense of like how are the ethics of what I've done, and how plausible is what I've done. And that's really useful as well.
One of the pieces of advice that I give to my students is like, make sure that whatever it is you're writing about is something that you care about enough that you're going to get through that period where you think that you want to die rather than write it anymore. And so if you are totally committed to this particular, not, you can't think like, well, I think this will get bought, or I think this is a popular topic, or I think this might be easy. Those are not good reasons to write something. But if you're totally committed to the material, then that will be the thing that will ride you through that period of difficulty and pain. I looked up something really quick because this is a nonfiction podcast. And I also wanted to mention this guy. I had a guy named Tom Schroeder, who used to be at the Washington Post, who edited a very long story that I wrote once about Iraq. And he wrote, this is the kind of feedback that I like. He wrote, generally, this is a good first draft, meaning this is not a good story. Generally, though, it is too expository and not narrative enough. Plus, there's only one character we get to know anything about. Personal about Sergeant Tate. The whole piece should read like a short story, three or four characters you get to know chronologically, following your days with the group, culminating in the near-death experience, but with the explanatory stuff coming off the narrative as opposed to the other way around. Much more personal storytelling, less newspapery. That was the whole comment. And I wrote the piece exactly like that. I mean, it was just a reminder. Those were all things that I knew to do, but that I had forgotten to do in the mess of trying to get my notes onto the page, you know? And so sometimes an editor who can just remind you of stuff that you're already supposed to know can be doing a good job.
Yeah, I think that I've heard a lot of people in recent years emphasize like the value of fresh eyes. And I think, of course, at some point when you've been writing something endlessly, you can't be your own fresh eyes. And so either you put something away for a long time and then go back to it, or you get someone who you trust to be fresh eyes. And I mean, it sounds actually like that editor, Tom Schroeder, did a great job of doing that for you, Whitney, in that instance. And yeah, I think just having someone who has almost no knowledge of your project, that's always the kind of feedback. Sometimes they'll react to something in a different way, and that can re-energize me about something. But I think it's also true that because you as a writer are always going to spend more time with your topic than anyone who reads your story, you really have to be so deeply interested in it, like really obsessed. And so sometimes like forcing yourself to take that space can also be difficult. But right, my first novel, I put away for several years and then went back to it. And I was pretty sure it was never going to see the light of day. And then when I went back to it, sort of all of its problems were very clear to me, which I think was just a function of my like forgetting a lot of it and then sort of turning into my own fresh eyes again. The other class that I taught this term was a comedy and humor class, a class that I began teaching several years ago because the material that I was immersed in was so deeply unfunny that I needed occasions when I was like, I will be guaranteed to see a happy thing on this day. So I taught that class as a literature class a few times. And then this year I taught it as a creative writing class. And then at some point I realized that my students felt like under intense pressure to be funny. and that they were sort of like, it just was, it wasn't actually helping them. And then at some point I was like, just so you know, I'm not actually grading you on whether you're funny. I'm grading you on whether you have turned your stuff in. A, because there's like a freaking pandemic. Like B, because like there's no way it's going to help you to sort of like freak out about, you know, I'd rather you try like a weird joke that doesn't work than tell me like, you know, the knock knock that I've heard four times before. And so they all immediately seemed to calm down. And I think I even calmed down a little bit as I was reading them and sort of didn't have to think so much about that. So I think like, I don't know, creating an atmosphere where people aren't as self-conscious, which means that the ability to be bad at things in front of each other, they watched a lot of stand-up and they had a lot of opinions about it. So actually watching people bomb on stage with like terrible jokes and then watching the way that they reacted, right? Because an audience will react to you immediately and sort of like not laugh at your joke if they think it's not good. And so how did all of these comedians handle it? And I think like watching a lot of professionals be vulnerable in that way and fail was actually really helpful. I don't know that I'm going to be assigning stand-up to my fiction classes anytime soon, but I think I might think about it because like there's, I mean, some of that stuff makes it into the comedy specials, you know, like you watch Amy Schumer or John Mulaney or someone tell a joke and then they're like, well, that one I should have left on the floor of the green room or whatever. And they have to deal with it in real time. And I think that my students were really comforted by that.
I feel like I'm too easily allow myself to write bad material. I don't have the problem of repressing it. I just write lots of really bad scenes and then have to cut them all. I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing. I do think that is just, I just know that that's how my process works for me when I'm writing fiction. Now, nonfiction is a different deal. I mean, I have a totally different physical process for writing it than I do writing fiction. Like fiction, I write on a typewriter, which may sound weird, but it prevents me from editing so that I can write bad scenes. But with nonfiction, I'm always working on a computer first draft. I mean, I put the fiction on a computer eventually so I can edit it, but I'm working on a computer and editing as I go and trying to write it like finished copy from start to finish, you know? And so I think I actually have less tolerance for writing bad stuff in my nonfiction work than in my fiction. And I do plan the nonfiction work more. I do tend to use an outline. I'll have notes, you know, and I'll order those and I'll use a bunch of sticky notes and all that sort of stuff. And so that tends to be less, that's harder for me to get started if I don't know what I'm doing.
Whitney mentioned sort of like planning stuff out, and planning stuff out can be helpful to give one a sense of security. But I think like, I remember going to see the comedian Russell Peters, who's Canadian, Indo-Canadian. And I saw him at the Fox Theater in Detroit, back when going to things in person was a thing. And I had watched him on YouTube a bunch. And then I got to this live performance and he had such a select number of perfectly polished diamond jokes. And I had seen them all. And I was like so underwhelmed. I was like, I mean, and this was someone who I had.
You mean it's like going to a concert where people play it exactly like it was on the album?
Yeah. I mean, I was just like, it's like so much of the joy of watching art or even sort of creating art for myself is that like I like having the outline and then I also like messing it up. And sort of the moment when you diverge from the path, like, right, the.
But do you do that with your nonfiction too?
Yeah, I think so. Because I mean, I'm also, we were both traditional reporters, but I think I now think of myself as an essayist before I think of myself as a journalist, which is probably a little bit of a mental flip for me. And so often an essay will take a turn that I did not anticipate coming, which I think probably didn't happen as much with straight reportage and tends to happen more with essays and or occasionally like magazine writing. Oh, no, it keeps it more interesting for me. And so I sort of think about it also as one of my students who had been taking, I mean, if you think about it in a screenwriting way, right, like you see the plan to like rob the bank. And in the movie, you know the plan before you see the scene, if it won't go according to plan. And if it's going to go according to plan, then you just see it happen. And so like either way, you're surprised.
Right.
And I think, I don't know, maybe that's something of what I want.
I'm curious to know what both Brendan and Sugi think of. I teach an essay by Donald Barthelme, who, you know, postmodern fiction writer, not a journalist. And it's called On Not Knowing. And he asserts that like what fiction writing is improvisation, and that you're not supposed to know what to do. And if you did know what you're doing, it would just be journalism. Now that was an essay written back in the day, Brendan, where when somebody like Bartholomew thought of nonfiction writing as a lower form than fiction. But I've tended to think increasingly that there is improvisation in particularly in creative nonfiction, that you don't, if you know all of the plan when you're going in, you won't be able to make those leaps. The leaps are different. I mean, you can't like decide that a character has a different backstory than they originally did, you know, like as you can in fiction. You can't do that in creative nonfiction, but you can decide to organize the story differently or have a different structure or start at a different beginning point. I mean, those were all the kinds of things that McPhee always talked about as being his inspirational moments were mostly about structure. Whereas in fiction, for me, those are about plot. And plot's a thing you can't really change in nonfiction. Well, he's a super accessible guy, and he is incredibly generous and giving. And he was the first person to line edit my work and then sit down with me and go over those line edits. And that's what he did in his class. And I remember writing a nonfiction piece for him that was a set piece, what he calls a set piece, which is about how to do something, you know, a physical process. So I wrote him an essay. I wrote like a piece about how to hang a seine net because I'd worked as a seine fisherman in Alaska. And he wrote at the end of it, he line edited the hell out of it, lots of marks. And then at the end, he's like, if you ever want to sign your work Whitney Terrell instead of Ebenezer Inkstain, you're going to have to correct these kinds of mistakes. So he was a very direct editor. And for me, that was like, thank God, because I felt like I'd been walking around with, you know, my pants undone, you know, and suddenly he was like, no, dude, you got to zip that up. And this is, you know, that doesn't look good, you know? And I was like, okay, thank you for telling me. I appreciate it. But that was all I knew how to write, you know? I mean, nobody had really ever done that for me. And so it was it was incredibly helpful. I mean, other than that, his ideas on structure and the things that were in his class, which is a famous class, he fortunately has, you know, written a book of essays that has a lot of those lectures in it, you know? And so those essays have appeared in the New Yorker over time. You can find them. I mean, those are the things that he would talk about in class as sort of a distilled version of those stories and ideas about structure.
Well, I think, in many ways, I think my students are so far ahead of, people of my generation who are educators. Like, for example, they're so fluid in different forms. They're working on video essays and hybrid genre, and I teach in a hybrid genre program. And so I think for me, it's been hugely useful for me as a writer to teach in a hybrid genre program, to have like, say, poets in my fiction writing workshops. And then also that forces me to rearticulate basic things that I think about fiction and to defend them in a way that has been helpful. So I think, and I've also, I teach my colleagues in fiction are Julie Schumacher and until recently, Charles Baxter. And Charles Baxter has been so key to, it's been really interesting to watch how his development of a specific kind of vocabulary has been really useful for people and thinking about like certain concepts. What Whitney was saying about how like one of the things you can change in fiction is of course plot and all of the different ways that Charlie talks about that. So thinking about, what are the terms that I have? What are the analogies I return to over and over again? And I think, maybe after like a decade of doing this, I have a few of those, which is nice. But I'm not the sort of person who sort of, like, I don't sit around writing a lot of craft essays, or I haven't. I think it's possibly something I would turn to. But I think, almost more than things like that, I hope that what I provide in some measure, what I think I can provide in some measure is a little bit of what we were talking about before, like kind of permission to fail. I think an MFA program, for example, like the one that I teach in, it's 3 years long. You have time to try something interesting that might fail. And I hope that I am able to model risk-taking in different ways. And that's about as ambitious as I think I can be on that front. Whitney, how about you?
Well, I'm always aware. I mean, I teach at the University of Missouri, Kansas City in our MFA program. And Sugi's at Minnesota, so we're both in the Midwest. And I always try to remember that for my students, the like world of the New York literary publishing houses, presses, and agents is far away. And I try to make sure that I am providing them with information about it and a sense of connection to it, that to make that it not feel so strange and far away to them. I am a reader for the New York Public Library's Young Lions Award. So we were reading, that's an award for writers under 35. So you're often reading first novels by people. I try to have my students read those and look at them and think about them and notice that some of these books are not very good, so that they're seeing who's being published and what's being published for the first time. And maybe they're looking at their own work and saying, oh, my work stacks up to this. I'm not that far away. You know, I try to constantly remind them of that, that I think the biggest difference between my students who are very talented and students who might be going to Iowa, but come to Iowa from Harvard, right? Or, an Ivy League school, or who are going to Columbia in New York City, or NYU or whatever. The biggest difference between those students and my students is that those students believe that they have a right and an expectation to be published, and my students don't, right? And so I want them to recognize that they're good, and I want to give them as much positive, personal, I don't want to use the word appreciation. Encouragement would be the better word, right? Like realistic encouragement, but I think there's plenty to be realistically encouraged about. And the podcast helps with that. We have students who work on the podcast, so they get to have interaction with the writers that we have on, and they're writers that they like or that they're aware of, so they know, hey, I can email this person. That's a real person. That, look, Sugi and Whitney are interviewing this writer that I know on the podcast. They're not a distant, hugely looming figure, right? They're just a person. And so I try to get them involved in the world of literature as much as possible in that way. My website is just my name, WhitneyTerrell.com. You can find my novels there and all my journalism as well. And you can also find us at the show is at LitHub. And they have a LitHub Radio tab. And if you scroll down, there's a bunch of podcasts on LitHub Radio. And we're the fiction/non/fiction podcast. So there's little slashes between our names, between our words.
And I'm at vasugi.com. That site hasn't been updated in a while. But my Facebook page also, that's sort of more recently updated. And then you can also find the podcast on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, all of those good places. And then in all the podcast apps, the LitHub radio station we've described is the streaming player. But you can, find us, as you mentioned, on iTunes, Stitcher, et cetera, et cetera. So
yeah, just type in the name. We always say fiction/non/fiction podcasts because you got to put the slashes in. And we that was a thing that we did that looked cool at the beginning. And now we're like, God, that was not a smart idea.
What at the end of my intro, what did I think it was the Kool-Aid man? Like, what was that? Anyway, how about those two? Wicked Snot. Best not to get in their way. My opinion. Know what I'm saying? I know when to get the hell out of Dodge and when not to. It behooves most people if I get the hell out of Dodge. Certainly this time around. Keep the conversation going on social media at CNFPod. Consider becoming a member of the Patreon community, patreon.com/CNFPod. We're slowly building a coalition. Now, tier 4, the ultimate high tier, is a $2,000 value that you ultimately get 10% off by being a member. If you're working on a book or working with me, is like earning an MFA for $1,800. It's $150 a month, and that's it. You're basically getting, in my opinion, an MFA for $1,800. So that's just tier 4. We're going to be adding a fifth episode of the podcast every month as I'm partnering with the Atavist magazine. Sayward Darby and her team, they always put out one blockbuster feature per month. Wicked long, wicked good. You know it. If you don't know what they're about, go check them out. And I will interview that writer and dig into that incredible journalism that they're doing. Sound cool? I think it does. The interviews will probably be a little shorter. I'm thinking 25, 30 minutes just to really get granular on the one piece and really hype it up. And also so I don't get too overworked while still celebrating what Sayward and Atavist are doing. Can't wait to do that. First one's coming soon, probably end of the month. Point being, tier one membership is $4 a month. And so that what podcast or I was doing 52 a year, you know, that was already less than a buck per episode. And now it looks like I'll be doing like 64 a year. I'm going to get my calculator out. Let's see. So 64 podcasts a year. So we're going $48 per year in the end divided by 64. That looks like 75 cents a podcast. 75 cents per podcast. Plus, you get new transcripts. You get transcripts from the moment you enroll. You get exclusive access to the audio magazine. Plus, exclusive audio that I just feed into the for patrons and other written content. And that's just the $4 a month tier. I'd hate for there to be only four people listening to the summer audio mag when over 500 people and more will download it over the course of the year. 500 people have enjoyed the one on isolation. Bringing in some scratch helps fund the enterprise because it is a lot of work, and I am not kidding. And I want to put that money in writers' pockets too. A little bit in mine, but also writers, because they're putting in the work and writers deserve that kind of, they deserve something, right? I think so. Got my first submission for the summer magazine already earlier today. So if you've got game, submit your essay, 2,000 words or fewer, the creative nonfiction podcast at gmail.com with summer in the subject line. Let me see your best. I want your best. If it's good enough, we'll worry about recording at that point. But write a killer 2,000 word or less essay or fewer essay. And no matter what, you're going to get a detailed critique from me. None of that form letter bullshit. Got it? Good. You can also head over to brendanomara.com for show notes and to subscribe to the monthly newsletter where you get entered in book raffles and get book recommendations, cool articles, news from the podcast, and an exclusive code for the monthly Zoom happy hour. This past one was this past Wednesday. We're publishing on this CNF Friday 2 days ago at the moment of this recording, and it was with, well, actually, it was last night. Anyway, you get it. By the time this hits your feed, it will have been 2 days ago. Whatever. And it was Elena Passarello, a CNF Pod alum, and just one of the best essayists in the goddamn country. I am telling you, man. Animal Strike Curious Poses, Let Me Clear My Throat. She's just a brilliant, amazing writer. So smart and funny, charismatic. And she was the featured guest on the Happy Hour. And so the people who joined the Happy Hour got to converse with Elena and pick her brain a little bit. And she picked other people's brains. She was incredibly generous, and it was just a whole lot of fun. And that's the kind of thing that's going to be coming down the pipe. It's the third one we've done, and I think we're just going to keep refining it and getting it better and better. If there's no guest, oftentimes I just pick a theme, and that theme is in the newsletter, and then we'll just riff on that theme, see what's going on with you. How can we help? How can we make your work better, make you feel better about the work, and all that stuff? Because it's easy to feel awful damn crummy these days, even though it's just the start of the year and you're supposed to be all New Year's resolutioned up, and sometimes you just feel bludgeoned by the world, by the circumstances we are under and living under. So it's meant to lift our spirits, and sometimes we need that. Sometimes we need that more than once a month, but at least we'll be there to lift each other up on that day. Once a month, no spam, so far as I can tell. You can't beat it. What else? What else is going on? I hit a little snag in the registration of Exit 3 Media, which is the production company that puts this together. It's essentially me. I think I accidentally registered it as a sole proprietorship when I really wanted it to be an LLC. So I reached back out to the Secretary of State and got to get that squared away. But that's where we're at. Tired as hell. So I'm going to call it quits. Is that all right? I'm going to call it quits, okay? So stay cool, CNFers. Stay cool forever. See ya.